Welcome to the podcast of Lancaster Brethren in Christ Church, located in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. LBIC is a community being transformed by the love of Jesus, sharing this love with all people. We want this podcast to be an extension of our community and a connection with familiar voices. Together, we want to think about how to follow Jesus in our particular moment. So enjoy the podcast. We're grateful to have you join us as a part of the LBIC family.
I would invite you, if you're able, to stand for the reading of the Gospel, Matthew 22 to 33. Immediately, he made the disciples get into the boat and go on ahead to the other side while he dismissed the crowds. And after he dismissed the crowds, he went up to the mountain by himself to pray. When evening came, he was there alone. But by this time, the boat, battered by the waves, was far from the land, for the wind was against them. And early in the morning, he came walking toward them on the sea. But when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were terrified, saying, "It is a ghost," and they cried out in fear. But immediately, Jesus spoke to them and said, "Take heart, it is I. Do not be afraid." Peter answered him, "Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water." And he said, "Come." So Peter got out of the boat, started walking on the water, and came toward Jesus. But when he noticed the strong wind, he became frightened, and beginning to sink, he cried out, "Lord, save me." Jesus immediately reached out his hand and caught him, saying to him, "You of little faith, why do you doubt?" When they got into the boat, the wind ceased, and those in the boat worshiped him, saying, "Truly, you are the Son of God." You may be seated.
Thanks to Joshua for, and it's Joshua now, so I've got that right. Thanks to Joshua for the invitation to share with you. It's been my privilege as well to know him these last several years. And for those of us who've devoted our lives to preparing people for the ministry, it's always just invigorating to see when it's done the way it's supposed to be done. And so we've been already encouraged and refreshed to be with you today. It's been kind of, if I can just say so right up front, it's been a fairly difficult last several days for us. Deborah and I moved back to Fresno from Lahaina. And so we lived in Lahaina up until recently, and the house we lived in is burned down, our church burned down. The friends we've heard from have lost all of their possessions, their homes, and we have several we've not heard yet from. So it's just kind of been a heavy week. So I want to lay that out and invite your prayers for the good people of Lahaina, for those who are making decisions on how in the world to proceed after such a catastrophic event. The death toll, as you know, continues to rise, and these are people very much in need of your prayers and even your gifts, and there are appropriate ways to do that. So we've been worshiping with you. What a gift. Just hearing your songs has lifted our shoes about an inch off the ground, and for that we're thankful. May the words of my mouth and the meditations of our collective hearts be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our rock and our redeemer. The Sea of Galilee is actually a really small body of water, about 15 miles north to south and 8 miles east to west. But perhaps more important than its size is its location and the way that it interacts with the land around it. The sea is surrounded by mountains, which create magnificent scenic views. But it leaves the sea in a virtual bowl, if you will, so that when wind from the Mediterranean to the west comes screaming through crevices in the surrounding mountains, this little lake in this little bowl almost immediately turns into a blender. I know. I've been in it. For years, Deborah and I led groups of students and pastors to the Holy Land, and on one occasion we instructed the bus driver to stop at a large tent on the eastern edge of the sea where they served St. Peter's fish. I won't describe it too thoughtfully before your dinner, but it was a delicacy for which the Sea of Galilee has long since been famous. Halfway through the meal, on an otherwise splendid sunny day, the wind came screaming through, and were it not for massive cables and huge pegs, would have torn the tent clear out of the ground and left it and us torched and drenched. We dodged a bullet that day. But here in Matthew 14, the disciples weren't quite so lucky. As the story unfolds, Jesus instructs the crowds that had gathered around him to make their way home, told the disciples to grab a boat and go to the other side of the sea while he climbed a mountain in hopes of finding some peace, some solitude, some space from the world that was around him. Quickly, the disciples, halfway around across the sea, found themselves in the middle of an unexpected storm, hanging onto the sides of a wind-driven boat for dear life. Like the string quintet playing Nearer My God to Thee on the deck of the tottering Titanic, these disciples abandoned their favorite choruses in favor of "Keep Me Safe Till the Storm Passes By." And they sing with gusto. Suddenly, in fact, as suddenly as the storm itself arose, the disciples see Jesus off in the distance, walking on the water. "Don't be afraid," he announces. "It's I." But before any of the other disciples have the opportunity even to come up for air, Peter cries out to the Lord, steps out, takes a few steps on the water, then sinks like an inner tube that just got hit by a dart. And Jesus, as he does, compassionately reaches down, pulls Peter out of the water, and there's no answer this time when Jesus says, "Why are you afraid?" Instead, he and Peter climb into the boat, and the writer tells us, and the storm subsided, and the disciples worshiped. It's a wonderful story, full of all sorts of twists and turns, high points, low points, makes its way to a climax at the end when the disciples are worshiping. It's a story that has nurtured countless believers over the years. And there are all sorts of things that we might say about it. Let me simply give you three words: separation, penetration, and what's the other one?
Concentration.
It's a good one, concentration. I'm trying to concentrate on the very thing that I forgot. Separation. Jesus is exhausted. He's spiritually, physically, and emotionally spent. According to Matthew's chronology, Jesus went through four strategic events just leading up to this event itself. He taught people that gathered around him on several of the parables, and we all know that teaching can be draining and exhausting. He was rejected by people in his hometown of Nazareth when he sought to minister there. He received the terrible news that his cousin and best friend and associate, John the Baptist, had been killed. And now he feeds the multitude, thousands, with just a few loaves and fish. He's exhausted. He's weary. He does all of this before modern technological projection systems and without fast food and without grief therapy. His divinity here doesn't override his humanity. So what does he do? Climbs the mountain, looking for a place to stay, to get some peace and quiet. Several years ago, when my sons were little, my daughter hadn't been born yet, we visited Kings Island Amusement Park down in Southern Virginia. And my youngest son was too little to ride the large roller coaster and too big to ride the kiddie one. But they had what we thought was a mid-size coaster. So Tim and Jordan and I get in my hands around Jordan, my little fella, and the college student working there pulls the lever, and the little coaster goes up and down, and I can tell Jordan tensing up just a bit. And when we pull into the station, the worker there forgot to pull the lever again. So the coaster went right through and started around the track again. We got into the station and we were finished, and I said, "Wow, isn't that amazing? Two rides for the price of one." And Jordan looked at me and he said, "Assuming you wanted to go again." Jesus knew when to get off the train. He made sure the instructor pulled the lever. Luke tells us that when Jesus was in Jerusalem ministering, he withdrew to Mount of Gethsemane on a regular basis. We're told that he did those sorts of things through all these strategic events. When he was securing his disciple service, he went and prayed all night. Mark tells us when he was ministering in Galilee, he got up while it was still dark. I remember Martin Luther saying he got up 3 hours every morning to pray, and if he had a busy day, four. And I always said, good for Martin Luther. But Jesus, it was part of his rhythm. He separated. He separated into this or from this world so that he could regain his equilibrium, so that he could be renewed. And if separation was part of Jesus' rhythm, it ought to be part of ours too. Our lives get chaotic. If it's not demands at work and responsibilities at home, activities at church, service projects in your community, if it's not papers to write, kids to be with, bills to pay, passwords to remember, and then you get on the phone to call your cell phone provider to try to have a faulty bill corrected, and you get one automated response after the other. When we were trying to get our passports, I waited online for 4 hours and never spoke to somebody. And I want to yell, "How do you get off the train?" You practice separation. You find quiet places periodically. You have a rhythm of space and peace for renewal and refreshment. Jesus, this kind of separation was part of his rhythm. But notice, secondly, penetration. Jesus doesn't separate permanently. He doesn't separate as a way of turning his back on the world. He doesn't separate out of surrendering to the chaos that's all around him. He separates with the intention of penetrating. These words kind of interchange in his life, in his rhythm. There's separation, penetration, separation, penetration. Here in Matthew 14, Jesus is up in the mountains, and his positioning there gives him a fantastic panoramic view of the sea beneath him. And as he looks down there, I'm sure he was aware of what the disciples were going through. He saw the lightning, heard the thunder, sensed the fear and anxiety that was rising within him. This was, by the way, mid-afternoon, and by the next morning, several hours later, Jesus responds. His timing isn't always the same as ours, but he penetrates. He makes his way down the mountain to these disciples. Now, when I look at this, it says he came to the disciples walking on the sea. For most of us, it's on the sea that's the problem. I mean, we may wash with water, drink with water, cook with water, do our laundry with water, but none of us walk on it, at least not in its liquid form. But Matthew says he came walking. That's what strikes me. If I were up in the mountains and somebody was, my dear friends were down below and they were in a crisis with something that I knew something about and could do to fix, I'd be zoom, the fix-it person that I am. But Jesus comes walking. He penetrates, but he doesn't panic. He penetrates, but he doesn't feel like he's carrying the whole weight of the world on his shoulder with a sense of desperation. He comes walking. Penetrating is part of Jesus' rhythm. And it should be a part of ours, too. In this world that we live in, I hardly have to tell you, is chaotic in so many ways. If it's not COVID, it's internal threats and brush fires and destroyed villages and towns. If it's not wars on one continent and unrest on the other, it's global warming and the falling economy and homelessness issues and the rising cost of real estate. It's a chaotic world. And the world deserves the best of us. The reflective, imaginative, courageous, compassionate acts of penetration into this world. Not withdrawing, not ignoring, not raising our hands in neglect. If Jesus practiced penetration, so should we. Let me give you one more word, and I remember it this time. Concentration. Look at Peter. God bless him. This impetuous individual cries out to the Lord, "If it's you, let me walk on the water." And Jesus says, "Come." And Peter jumps out of the boat, walks along the water. And then the writer tells us in this little scary phrase, "But when he noticed." But when he noticed. He shifts his gaze. He adjusts his point of vision. It's interesting if you look through the scriptures how important noticing is. We're told in Genesis 3 that when Eve noticed that the fruit was good, she devoured it. Or we're told later, not once, but twice, when Samson was roaming around among the Danites, he saw a prostitute and went in with her. Or David, the righteous man that he is, the writer of the Psalms, he's out on the top of his castle or his temple, sitting on the roof. He looks across the road at Bathsheba, bathing. And when Joseph would have run to get out of there, David noticed and asked for more information. Is it any wonder that the writer of Proverbs suggested that, prayed, Lord, help us to keep our gaze straight? Or Jesus had the audacity to say, if your eye causes you to stumble, for Pete's sake, cut it out. Or the writer to the Hebrews wrote, as we make our way through this world, keep your eyes on Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. Well, how do we keep our eyes on somebody who's not walking around with us anymore? How do you keep your eyes on somebody who's been resurrected and ascended into heaven and isn't even with us anymore? There's one snapshot after the other right here for us to look at. Just think about it for a moment. A woman who was caught in adultery and about to be stoned. Nobody cared about her. And Jesus got down and said, I forgive you. Go and sin no more. Or Peter, who had denied him three times, standing on the shore of Galilee itself. And Jesus setting him free. Put it behind you, Peter, and let's go on from here. Or Jesus with a rich young ruler having the audacity to tell this man to sell everything that he had and give it to the poor. Or Jesus casting the buyers and sellers out of the temple, wanting nothing to do with making a mockery of his father's name. All of these give us glimpses into a patient, loving, demanding, gracious, you list the adjectives, Jesus, that we can look at again and again and again. We separate to be renewed and restored and refreshed. We penetrate to make a profound difference in this chaotic world of ours. And all the while we do those two things, we keep our eyes focused on Jesus. Just Tuesday of this past week, Deborah and I were in Massachusetts, and we went to drove for a little ways to meet my brother, who lives in New Hampshire, and I only see him once a year. Oh my word, I can't tell you how hard it rained. It wasn't raining drops, it was raining buckets. But I wasn't about to be denied this opportunity to see Barry again. And so we're moving through this torrential downpour. And for a few moments, we'd pull off the road into the parking lot until the rain just subsided a bit or two. We'd catch our breath, let our nerves ease up. Then we get back on the road and penetrate and travel a little bit further. And then we'd separate and then we'd penetrate as we made our way along. And the writer of the Hebrews says, you and I are all on a journey heading toward a city not yet seen. We're moving in this direction, separating, penetrating. But do you know the entire drive, I had my eyes focused on the car ahead of us and watching his brake lights, seeing if he hit a puddle, knowing if he swerved off to the left or to the right. And by watching that car ahead of us, we gradually made our way to our destination. We were at a conference in Orlando, Florida some years ago and had the privilege of hearing a particular speaker whose name I don't recall. But I remember one thing in the whole sermon that he said over and over and over again. Don't focus on your condition, but instead on God's position. I wonder how often I've reminded myself. Separate, yes, penetrate, but concentrate your focus on Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. With that level of concentration, we're going to make it to that city not yet seen. Would you pray with me? Lord, give us the wisdom, the grace of your indwelling spirit to live lives with the kind of rhythm that you lived, pacing ourselves, resting in you, keeping our focus ahead of us. We're grateful, Lord, that we're grateful for the city toward which we're moving, and by your grace we will one day see. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit, amen.